you have incurred $120 million in royalty payments so far in the life of this mine. We're yet to make a profit. We've paid $120 million in royalties.
So you've paid $120 million in royalties to the state government, to Queensland Treasury, but your company has not made a profit.
That's right, yeah.
Welcome to the Baseload Podcast. My name is Ben Beatty. Just a few days ago, relative to when I'm recording this podcast, Nick Jorce spoke to Steve Austin on ABC Radio talking about the closure of his Burton mine in North Queensland. A sad state of affairs indeed. And paying royalty on revenue, not on profits, is the main reason those guys have suffered.
So the previous government brought in the royalty regime, which imposed a peak rate of 40% of revenue, not profits, revenue, regardless of profitability.
That's right, and regardless of whether you can pay your wages or pay your other suppliers. And, of course, costs have gone up significantly as well. So, you know, I think, the former Labor government ran the line, well, we had a royalty freeze for 10 years, but that's kind of like saying we've had a GST freeze for 10 years. I mean, costs have all gone up, and they haven't whacked the GST up from 10 to 20, 30 and 40%, which is what they've done with coal royalties.
Nick Jorce doing a great job of keeping his cool there. The mining sector is full of ups and downs, and Nick, despite having a rough week, was one of the first to have a laugh at a character called Jerry Noonan, who went viral on the internet for, shall we say, a colourful spray. Let's hear it. I've spared listeners the most colourful adjectives.
What does the future look like regarding electrification and battery electric vehicles in your mining operations, son?
Well, we have coal because we've got the biggest coal deposits in the world, but we're not allowed to burn the f***ing stuff, so the world's rooted, really. It's all right to be idealistic, but you also have to be realistic. No, you might f***ing laugh, but it's true. You understand what I'm talking about. I'm not talking bullshit, I'm talking reality. If we don't get realistic, we're f***ed. It's as simple as that. We're not allowed to use uranium. We've got the biggest uranium deposits in the world in Australia. We're not allowed to mine the f***ing stuff. So it's all fucked. So when half these cunts die, well, the world will be a better place, and then those of us that survive will get it going again. My next-door neighbour, I was talking to him, he's a lawyer, so he's not an idiot. Well, he is a f***wit, but that's another problem. But he said, oh, that's right, you just put plugs along the highways. I said, but if you haven't got a fucking source from a power station, plugs on the highways aren't going to do fucking jack shit, right? Do you understand me? The people don't understand. They think the electricity comes out of fucking space. But if you haven't got a charging system, which is a steam coal burning power station, how the fuck can you charge your batteries? Do you understand that?
Yeah, I understand.
Well, there's a lot of the cunts don't, and that's the problem with the world.
Thank you, Jerry. Well said. It's hard to picture that being scripted any better. Now, it has been a while between episodes. Not asking for forgiveness. Life happens to us all. This episode, though, hopefully, will be worth the wait. Robert Bryce is the interview this time. Robert Bryce was a guest of the IPA, the Institute of Public Affairs in Australia, through June. He toured the capital cities, doing a riveting speech talking about energy and his experiences in America and around the world. He's written books. He's a journalist of long-standing repute. And it was very gracious of the IPA, Scott Hargraves and team, to schedule Robert some time with me. So I sat down with Rob for about 40 minutes, did an interview face-to-face, and we had a good chat. He's good to hang. I hope you guys enjoy the interview. I recommend jumping into the IPA. Give him a list, give him a like, give him a follow, even become a member, maybe. $100 a year or so. Who else is bringing guests of the quality of Robert Bryce to Australia to talk about energy or anything? One of the things that's kept me occupied from podcasting and writing in general, I guess, is data, national electricity market data. Now, if anyone who's ever dived into the NEM web and all the gigabytes of spreadsheets, CSV files and XML files in there, bid per, bid day might trigger you, I don't know. Now, I'm an engineer, I'm not a coder, although I have done DCS and PLC programming back in the past, and it's not that much different. It's just that I'm not prepared to spend the time to learn the intricate details. So like most able-bodied people these days, I dive into the AI, and that's been a big help and sped things up quite a lot. The primary target of my data analysis, my crude analysis, to be honest, is the bidding data. Now, I was inspired by a blog post on the well-respected, highly impartial, they take great pains to be impartial, good on them in the debate, the What Clarity. Now, What Clarity, they've been writing some good stuff for years, and something they put up a couple of years ago as part of their generated digest was a red, blue, and green chart. Now, red, blue, and green are the colours of the price bands, and this is a chart that showed blue at the bottom, green in the middle, and red at the top. Each colour represents a bidding dollars per megawatt hour, and blue being below zero, green being between zero and $300 a megawatt hour, and red being above $300 per megawatt hour. And what their chart showed was the green ones disappearing, the middle bands. Now, the middle band, 0 to 300, 300 sounds pretty high, but it's not that high when you're talking about a market cap of nearly $20,000 now. The disappearing middle band makes sense because the middle band is mostly occupied by coal. And what is the purpose of the transition, in inverted commas and in capitals, registered trademark copyright, is to delete coal from the system. No one can deny that. Now, what happens when you delete coal from the system is you drastically change how the merit order effect works. Now, the merit order effect is, well, it boils down to what the renewables lobby and the sycophants and basically the people who don't know anything about it or how it works or have not paid attention or who willingly do not want to know. The merit order effect basically says the highest bid sets the price. And that's of the bid stack. And the bid stack is set by the dispatch engine from the market operator, which is AEMO. For every 5-minute period of every day, they need to make the megawatt supply match the megawatt demand. And how do they do that? Well, they know pretty much what the demand's going to be. And so then they start building their bid stack using the cheapest first. And once they get to the megawatts they need, it's just a little trimming around the edges that finally sets the price. But the main impact is the bulk electricity supply, which is set from the cheapest to the highest, and the highest set the price. Now, the merit order effect, as explained by those who think renewables reduce the wholesale price, is that you put more cheap stuff in the bottom, and that shifts the bid stack so that the price is set by lower cost generators. Now, that sounds okay intuitively, except that's not what happens. What happens is the middle price generators go away, which is the coal. The high price stuff stays. So it doesn't, filling in the bottom of the bid stack with the El Cheapo stuff, like the wind and solar, which bids at the price floor because they're all paid on contract, immune to the wholesale price largely. The problem is that you're not getting rid of the high stuff. And if you don't get rid of the high stuff, the wholesale price doesn't come down, it goes up. What we're doing is getting rid of the cheap stuff, the middle stuff. And that's the coal. Now, if you take a step back and don't talk about prices or anything, all the policy is pointed at getting rid of coal. No one can deny that. That's exactly what the policy is. The renewable energy target, now the capacity investment scheme, net zero, it's all getting rid of coal. That's all they ever talk about. Now, the problem with that is that coal inhabits this $0 to $100 region in the merit order. And if we had a lot more $0 to $100 electricity in the wholesale market, the price would settle there more often. But it doesn't. We're not getting rid of... If you think about it a different way, we're building lots and lots more wind and solar. Yes, okay. Everyone accepts that they bid into the market very cheap. We're building lots and lots of batteries. We're building a little bit of gas and big chunks of hydro here and there. So the gas, the batteries, and the hydro are all very expensive. They all sell their electricity for very high prices in the wholesale market. We're not building anything that sells us electricity in the $0 to $100 range, which is dispatchable, which is there all the time. That's coal, and we're getting rid of it. That's the root cause of why wind and solar, or the strategy that we're on at the moment, the trajectory they're on at the moment, cannot reduce wholesale prices. You know, you can see this in the data. People refuse to accept this. There was a guy on LinkedIn the other day was telling me, oh, look at my data. He said, I'm showing you this data that shows it that renewables does lower the prices. And he was showing me, he had a chart which said, oh, day-to-day data, day-to-day prices, something in the hourly range. And I'm like, well, okay, sure. Your data shows that, but who cares? It doesn't mean anything. No one's buying electricity by the hour. Retailers and corporates, councils, governments, etc., buy electricity quarterly. So the quarterly data matters. The quarterly's going up. Anyway, I did some charts, which inspired by the What Clarity guys, and I went back and I got all the, you know, the gigabytes of data and ran some code, and now I can filter it by which state, by fuel type, by date range, all that kind of good stuff, and it all shows the same thing. It shows that the $0 to $100 range is disappearing, and that seems obvious to me. I stuck it up on LinkedIn and Twitter, as you do. LinkedIn and Twitter are different ecospheres, I guess you'd call them. LinkedIn, there isn't any real anonymity. Whereas LinkedIn, you do get all sorts of anonymity. And but interestingly, on LinkedIn, people are actually far ruder, I've found. There's a certain clique of people who are, what's a nice way to say it so that your grandma can listen? Obnoxious trolls is what I've settled on. Obnoxious trolls. They don't really know much, but they're always there. They're always piping up. And yeah, they're always fun. We've had some controversy about the capacity investment scheme. So when you go through the tender one pro formas, there's four tenders at the moment. Tender one and tender four are largely the same, chasing bulk wind and solar. This is the big gigawatt numbers that they're having, 32 gigawatts expanded out to 40 gigawatts now under Chris Bowen's scheme. And you've also got that's tender one and tender four, and you've got tender two, I think, is storage, and tender three is Western Australia, or vice versa. It doesn't matter. They don't mean much. Not to me anyway, when I'm looking at the greater scale of things. But tender one, the documentation that goes with the tenders shows that curtailment is paid for. You're not, the wind and solar generators are not paid on just the megawatt hours that they generate. They're paid on deemed megawatt hours, which is a calculation based on historical figures. It's a capacity factor number, and I guess they can work that out between them and AMO Services and Chris Bowen. People like Simon Holmes of Court swear black and blue that this is not the case, and he said to me on LinkedIn that you know, I'm full of it. And I said, well, Simon, all due respect, I think you're full of it. So that went back and forwards a couple of times. But the end of the shot, the upshot of it is, if you go to the AMO Services website and you look at the tender information for tender one and you look at the calculation, it shows it in black and white. So I don't know. You work it out. Tender four is different, which is also interesting. And Aidan Morrison has been digging into this a little bit. And it turns out that maybe, I don't know, did AMO Services stuff up the paperwork? Did the lawyers get it wrong? I don't know, but I guess we'll be finding out soon enough, hopefully. Well, maybe we won't. Maybe it'll all be hidden away in the secret chambers of these agreements. Okay, that's enough of a rant or an introduction to this episode. Let's get into it. Alrighty, here's a quick mashup between two different interviews, Lily D'Ambrosio, Victorian Energy Minister, and Emma Webb, a concerned New South Wales farmer. Now, obviously, they're in different states. One's policy doesn't apply to the other one, but I just wanted to compare a sense of authenticity, I guess, between the two.
Look at me, please. Look at me.
Investor conference is absolutely critical, absolutely. I would say to any investor that's got planning approval or is looking to get planning approval in Victoria for projects, please keep coming. Please keep your eye on the opportunities here in this state, because you will be you should be confident that you will be able to connect up and be able to sell your electricity at the time that you expect it to be available to you.
We know how these projects operate now because there are, especially in our region, we are absolutely saturated in wind turbine projects. So we know how they operate. And so this project will be pushed through the approvals process by underselling the impact on people and on people's lives.
Well, look, these things have to happen, Giles. I mean, you know, we're very big on consultation. There's been a lot of work on consultation, absolutely. But at the end of the day, they've got to be built. They've got to be built, and they will be built. They will be built in a timely fashion, in a way that ensures that the proponents of new projects that need to be built can have confidence that, that by the time they finish building their projects, they'll have somewhere to connect to and start getting revenue for their investment dollar.
This is what developers do, and they do it right around the country. They come into rural communities and they splash around a lot of cash, and then rural communities are torn apart.
Now, guess what? Renewables ticks all those boxes. So that is one of the reasons why we set about having ambitious but doable renewable energy targets. And, Jos, we've met every single target. In 2020, we met our 25% target. This year, we are effectively meeting our 40% renewables energy target in 2025. And our target for 65% by 2030 is absolutely doable. That's why we set the targets as we do. 95% definitely by 2035, that is absolutely achievable.
Certainly a degree of moral superiority that is thrown around. It's claimed, obviously, to be environmental and they're trying to save the world. And we were even asked if we want to keep the lights on, so which is really a condescending thing to ask a group of people. But it really was... It's quite a disgusting display of arrogance and entitlement that we saw last week at our town meeting.
And look, can I just say that in terms of the status of the Victorian Transmission Plan, the draft, it is genuinely a consultation, okay? Absolutely. And I know that VicRid, who's the government agency for those outside Victoria, who are managing that consultation, they're talking and understanding. It won't be long before we finalise that transmission plan.
They really did stop trying to sell the project to us, and they basically just told us it's a state significant project. We have a licence to do this from the very top, and we're here, and we are charging ahead in the face of overwhelming community opposition.
Even with building offshore wind, we still need to build about, from where we are now, about 17 gigawatts combined of renewable generation and storage capacity onshore. So we still need to build a lot onshore anyway.
And so that's why we're making a lot of noise now to try and stop this impact that is having on our community already and what we can see will happen to our community if the project goes ahead.
So we're listening to the feedback. We'll be taking that into account, absolutely, as we finalise the VTP. I want all investors to understand that very clearly.
There's non-disclosure agreements that are in place and it's all very much behind closed doors, and it's been going on for at least 2 years that we know about. We've only just found out about it.
I would say to any investor that's got planning approval or is looking to get planning approval in Victoria for projects, please keep coming. Please keep your eye on the opportunities here in this state, because you should be confident that you will be able to connect up and be able to sell your electricity at the time that you expect it to be available to you.
This will go right through the planning approvals process, and even then, you know, we wait and see what happens, because at the moment we have two levels of government who, you know, are for these projects, and so we, as a rural community, we feel a bit voiceless and powerless against that.
I would say to any investor that's got planning approval or is looking to get planning approval in Victoria for projects, please keep coming. You should be confident that you will be able to connect up and be able to sell your electricity.
So on top of that comparison between the Victorian Energy Minister and a concerned New South Wales farmer, New South Wales Energy Minister Penny Sharp has introduced, and I believe they've had passed now, a new bill to the New South Wales legislature, which goes like this. The title of it is Electricity Infrastructure Investment Amendment Priority Network Projects Bill 2025. Now, this is quite a how do I say it without resorting to Jerry Noonan tactics? This is a hell of a thing. So apparently, the purpose of the bill is to amend the Electricity Infrastructure Investment Act 2020. Sounds like a Matt Keane project to me, to enhance the framework for directing network projects to respond to reliability and system security risks in a timely manner. So we've got some key words in there. We've got reliability, system security, and timely. We've also got it wrapped in this thing called enhance the framework. So there's some suspicious things in there, because primarily it doesn't mention cost at all. And it doesn't mention much consultation. So here, a couple of bullet points about what this bill is needed to do. And this is direct quotes from the website. The bill is needed to broaden the definition of priority transmission infrastructure projects to include transmission and distribution projects and various other things. The bill is needed to allow the minister to issue more than one direction or authorization for a project. Allow the minister to issue directions or authorizations to more than one network operator in relation to the same project. Enable directions to take effect sooner where the minister is satisfied that reasonable financial arrangements are in place. Strengthen requirements on directed parties to comply. Narrow the grounds on which a network operator can be excused from non-compliance with a direction. Interesting. So there's nothing really about consumer protection in there. It's all framed around giving the minister or making the network companies comply with a minister's directions. Let's read on a bit further. Objectives. What is the policy's objective couched in terms of the public interest? Right, here we go. This might raise cost. The Act coordinates and encourages investment in new electricity generation storage network and related infrastructure by reducing risk for investors. That doesn't sound like consumers to me. They said investors. They didn't say reducing risk for consumers. They said reducing risk for investors. The Act provides for the minister to direct network operators to carry out priority transmission projects and renewable energy zone network infrastructure projects. Directions make clear what needs to be done and by when, provide certainty to directed parties, and facilitate cost recovery from electricity consumers. Wow, so that's not really protecting consumers. That's opening the gates. What else does it say? It says the bill expands the definition of priority transmission infrastructure projects. This will expand the options available to address emerging reliability and security constraints in shorter timeframes. Stepping away from that at the moment, in engineering world, higher risk and shorter timeframes means higher cost. I wonder where we've heard that before. Okay, back to the ministerial amendments to the legislation. The amendments allow the minister to issue more targeted directions and to issue more than one direction for a single project. For example, the minister could issue a direction relating to preparatory activities followed by a direction for construction, commissioning, and operation. So the minister can now say, do the preparatory activities and then construct, commission, and operate that, whatever that is. Well, that's interesting because normally your preparatory activities, preparatory, whatever the word is, I'm sticking with preparatory, might include a cost-benefit analysis. I wonder if you still need a cost-benefit analysis to do this or if the minister can just direct that away. Back to this document, the bill empowers the minister to issue directions to different parties working on the same project and to direct a network operator to operate infrastructure owned by another party. Sounds like more control for the minister. Let's see, scrolling down a bit, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Consultation. Were the views of affected stakeholders sought and considered in making the policy? Okay, the answer to this, let's read this in full. It's only a couple of lines. Here we go. Yes, the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water, undertook targeted consultation with key stakeholders during the drafting of the bill. The department consulted network service providers, the Energy Corporation of New South Wales, and the Australian Energy Regulator. The views of these stakeholders were considered and have informed the content of the bill where appropriate. So, we have here a bill that gives the minister, the energy minister of a state, carte blanche powers to direct preparatory construction, commissioning, and operation, to recover investment from consumers, to reduce risk for investors. And who do they consult? Ausgrid, Endeavour Energy, Essential Energy, Transgrid, Energy Co, and the AER. Thanks very much. I mean, Victoria can only wish they had ministerial control of that level.
I would say to any investor that's got planning approval or is looking to get planning approval in Victoria for projects, please keep coming. You should be confident that you will be able to connect up and be able to sell your electricity.
A fucking goat outside.
It's just a goat.
No, it's a fucking goat.
All right, the goat this episode is taking on the one and only John Grimes of the Smart Energy Council, he who has been there for 17 years, apparently. Okay, it's gone quite well for him, I must say. They're, I guess they're on top of the program at the moment with the capacity investment scheme, the battery rollouts, the general power grab from the state governments. It's all happening for them. The rooftop solar continues to happen. Nothing's really getting in their way. Unfortunately, it's the poor old farmers who are hugging the trees and not the power lines. As I saw a cartoon recently on social media, John Grimes, he spoke to the National Press Club in July, and this is the result. I'm not gonna pretend that I enjoyed listening. This guy's, not my favorite. And knowing my audience, you know, thinks along the same lines as me, I'm not going to subject anybody to the full onslaught of the propaganda mission that is John Grimes. What I am going to say is that let's pull out a few sections and see what the goat has to say about it. Enjoy.
Renewable energy is the key to our national prosperity and to our economic security.
It's a fucking goat.
All right, we're off to a cracking start there with Mr. John Grimes of the Smart Energy Council addressing the press club a couple of weeks ago. Now, I spoke to the goat, and the goat has informed me that in this episode, in this edition of the Baseload podcast, he's gonna take on Mr. Grimes. He's gonna interject. The goat's going to interject when he feels there's something that needs to be interjected on. But he's also going to call it out when John Grimes accuses the other side of exactly what he's doing.
Smart Energy Council represents the multi-billion dollar firms that invest in the transition. The big developers building wind, solar, and big batteries right across the grid.
And that, my friends, is 100% correct. No goat there.
Now, everybody knows the one thing you can do to slash your power bills is to install solar. And now, thanks to the federal government's Cheaper Home Batteries program, get a battery in your garage as well.
Okay, that might sound like a tough call on the goat there, because, of course, you can put a battery in your garage, and solar panels on your roof will save you money. But it has to be your roof, it has to be your garage, and it has to be your money that pays for it to start with. And that, therefore, leaves out a whole bunch of people. And I must point out that at the start of that little extract, Mr. Grimes did say that, you know, installing rooftop solar is the only way to reduce your power bill. And that's kind of true.
Power bills don't matter all that much to the rich.
Oh, he's a slippery character, is Mr. Grimes. Of course, power bills in your residence don't matter that much to the rich. And let's point out that, as of the last couple of years, the wealthiest electorates are Labor and Teals and Greens. They are the ones that benefit the most from these policies because they're most likely to A, own their own house, B, not an apartment, and have a garage off-street parking. Therefore, they can charge an EV as well at home. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Everyone has what they have, and I'm not the person to be complaining about it. But I do feel the need to point out the hypocrisy of the John Grimes characters, who say that this is the appropriate strategy, is to continue to pander to the wishes and the whims of people in these wealthy electorates who primarily vote for these policies and do not have to suffer the negative effects of these policies.
It's a uniquely Australian approach. Successive Australian governments have focused on households, kicked off by Prime Minister John Howard. Today, we have the most efficient, safe and cost-effective rooftop solar sector in the world.
Yes, but these rooftop solar policies have contributed to Australia in general having some of the highest electricity costs in the developed world.
Take the solar, battery and EV company BYD. You might have seen the cars, the build your dream cars popping up on the streets. Well, last year that company had revenues of $160 billion. More than twice the revenue of BHP, the big Australian.
Okay, the goat's jumping in here, not to try and dispel any myths. I think Grimes is probably correct about his figures there. I mean, he wouldn't be so confident about it if he hadn't checked, obviously. But he is very pro-China. What did he say at the start of his speech?
Smart Energy Council represents the multi-billion dollar firms that invest in the transition.
Indeed. And we should not forget this. John Grimes, as head of the Smart Energy Council, is the head of a lobby group that represents big business. And the Chinese are a large part of that, obviously. Who else is John Grimes a fan of? The Joe Biden administration in America. Well, not anymore. Here he is talking about how great the Biden subsidies were and how bad the Trump leveling the playing field is.
Now, for a brief moment, it looked like the US would put themselves in contention for a podium finish. The Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, unlocking $1 trillion in investment. Then on Friday, the 4th of July, President Trump signed his big, beautiful bill. Now, I'll leave it to Elon Musk to critique. I want to travel to the US. It gives handouts to industries of the past while severely damaging industries of the future. Hear, hear, Elon Musk. It is an effective US surrender out of the energy transformation race.
Yeah, honesty and reality have returned to Washington, D.C. That's thanks to President Trump. Coal has been the biggest source of electricity globally for 100 years, and it is today by far. It's not number one in the U.S. today. Today it's been passed by natural gas, but together with nuclear, natural gas, and coal, it's over 75% of U.S. electricity, and it's why the lights are on when it's cold, when the wind's not blowing, when your kid needs that urgent health care. Coal is a critical part of the American economy, not just our electricity grid. You can't make steel without coal. We make a lot of steel in the U.S. and we want to make a lot more.
I presume that Mr. Grimes has no love for U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright either. Meanwhile, in Australia's performative politics, our own energy minister, Mr. Chris Bowen, is still pushing hydrogen.
There's plenty of people who say our green hydrogen's too hard. There's plenty of them in politics. There's plenty of them in the media, sitting like Statler and Waldorf up watching the Muppets criticising everything. Well, actually, green hydrogen is hard, but not impossible.
Clean energy is not just a climate policy. It's an industrial strategy.
Yeah, if you're an idiot.
A productivity strategy. And the good news is that Australia is doing well, punching above our weight.
I mean, I look at the energy system these days and I think, are we doing well, really? And are we punching above our weight? What does that even mean? It means nothing. It's just, again, it's performative, ridiculous eco-bubble speak. And John Grimes is the master of it.
12 years ago, 10% of our electricity was renewable. Today, we're at 41%.
And those numbers are correct, but they hide some of the truth. In reality, that includes all the old hydropower, any biomass, which is also, you know, not that great for the environment if you're interested in the emissions side of it. And so the wind and solar are quite a bit less. With industrial wind and solar in the national electricity market just cracking 25%. And this is one of the reasons why getting an honest, factual, objective debate about our energy systems is so difficult, because there's multitude of ways to cut this particular cookie. You can talk about the wholesale market, or you can talk about retail. And even when you talk about the electricity share, they say renewables. Well, half the bloody renewables have been there for 50 years already.
Remember, China's at 40. Extraordinary size of their economy.
China is 40% renewable electricity? No. Let's go to a website, emberenergy.org, countries and regions/China. China power sector overview, share of generation, percent. Oh, look, coal, 58%. Hydro, 13%. Wind, 9%. Solar, 8%. So no, China, and there's some nuclear in there as well. So China is not at 40% renewables, as Grimes says it is, in proper renewable speak, which is talking about the industrial wind and solar. China is, you know, not even 20%.
Remember, China's at 40. Extraordinary.
Super extraordinary, because it's not even true.
And Australia wins a gold medal. The most solar energy produced per person on a per capita basis.
Again, who cares? It's not a metric that matters. What matters is the price per unit. And we are paying a lot per unit, partly because of our stupid solar policies.
On track to meet and beat our targets by unlocking big renewables, large scale.
Someone else who made a speech recently was Ross Garno. Now, I don't know about you listeners, but I've lost all respect for these fake intellectuals and these fake academics and these fake experts. They don't know what they're talking about.
We've been slowly winning, and slowly winning is losing.
And this is another contradiction, you know, that the renewables lobby and their sycophants always come up with. Oh, we're doing so well. Look how great we are. We're at 40% renewables. We're going to meet all our targets. But then you flip the coin and they go, yeah, but we just need more money, more subsidies, more targets. Help us out. Come on, guys.
My new book came out late last year, Let's Tax Carbon and Other Ideas for a Better Australia, focuses on how the next parliament has to go faster. It has to go faster to give Australia a chance of restoring prosperity after more than a decade of stagnant living standards for Australians. Stagnant living standards that will be extended by climate disruption.
Gosh, enough of this claptrap. Let's get back to the main event. And where is Mr. Grimes up to in his speech? I wonder what adjacent to the facts comments he'll come up with next.
Take the world's cheapest renewable energy in places like South Australia.
Not too many people out there say that South Australia has cheap electricity. I mean, just a simple look at the Canstar Blue website, which takes you to the various retailers and lists them, you know, by the cheapest offer, comparing a flat rate in Adelaide compared to my flat rate. So it'd be 41 cents a kilowatt hour in Adelaide versus 33 cents a kilowatt hour here in Brisbane. Obviously, you've got some other things in there. For example, your fixed daily costs, things like that. But that consumption rate, goodness me. Anyway, Grimes is going on about using cheap renewables to turn iron ore into steel. Now, this is a fantasy land of green hydrogen. We've talked about green hydrogen many times in the past. The only people pretty much in the world still talking about green hydrogen are Chris Bowen and John Grimes. So good luck to them. Unfortunately, it's all our money they're playing with. So now we turn the corner of this section and Grimes' speech. He's a good speech writer. If you consider, you know, being parallel to the facts, a good speech. Earlier when I introduced this segment, I talked about the proclivity of the progressive left accusing others of what they do themselves. Now, interestingly enough, there's a document floating around on the internet. It's actually in the Queensland Parliament website, and it's called a funding proposal for the Australian anti-coal movement, stopping the Australian coal export boom. So this is put together by John Hepburn of Greenpeace Australia, Bob Burton, I don't know who he is, and someone else called Sam Hardy of the Graham Wood Foundation. And it talks about, you know, this proposal is based on extensive research into the Australian coal industry made possible by the generous support of the Rockefeller Family Fund. The proposal consists of three parts: an overview of the Australian coal export boom, a strategy to disrupt the Australian coal boom, and this campaign proposal. Who's inside it? You've got Mark Ogg from Beyond Zero, now with the Australia Institute, Paul Usting of GetUp, plenty of other people in there whose names, Richard Dennis, the Australia Institute, all our well-known people. And what does it do? The proposal: we are seeking investment to help us build a nationwide coal campaign that functions like an orchestra, with a large number of different voices combining together into a powerful symphony. The proposed campaign program has multiple projects that contribute to one another and overlap. Prospects are broken down into two levels. Level one is the base level of resourcing that is required to have an impact. Level two is where we need to make the program in order to have maximum impact. Then they have a list of, they want to spend, you know, $1 million on litigation just for one project. And the total sum of this is about $3.7 million. And this is in 2011 dollars. And there wouldn't be any, you know, foreign intervention or overseas money in that, would there, you know, from our friends in the Northern Hemisphere? No, that wouldn't happen at all, would it? And who has the most to benefit from shutting down coal in Australia? I also wonder about that.
Smart Energy Council represents the multi-billion dollar firms that invest in the transition.
John Grimes goes on a bit of a rant here in his speech and accuses governments of all sorts of things. Some of it's partly true. Some of it is just fantasy. Let's have a listen.
Strangely Trumpian in a world before Trump the politician. Going all in on an economic and engineering lie. A lie that sits at the heart of the not-so-secret coalition agreement between the Liberal and National parties. That renewables can't compete.
That's true.
That they're too weak.
Yep.
Too unreliable.
Indeed. That's why they don't exist without subsidies.
Axe the $2.3 billion cheaper home battery program.
Yep. Buy your own batteries. I do not want to be buying other people's batteries.
Scrap new vehicle efficiency standards.
Yep. That's a carbon tax on vehicle manufacturers, which will make everything cost more.
Kill the $25 billion Future Made in Australia program.
Yes.
Abandon the $19 billion Rewiring the Nation initiative.
Yes.
Shut down the Net Zero Economy Agency.
Yes.
Take away the tax breaks for electric vehicles.
Yes.
Cancel production tax credits mm-hmm. for clean hydrogen mm-hmm. and critical minerals.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And either follow Trump out of the Paris Agreement
yep.
or scrap the targets
yes.
in breach of it.
Absolutely.
No support for solar.
None.
No plan for famine.
Not fair.
But plenty for the coal and gas industry.
No.
Just as there's a through line, a direct link from those young Chinese researchers in
Is he going to say that he's owned by the Chinese? What's he going
to
say?
To that multi-trillion dollar industry, there's another through line from big fossil fuel interests to the biggest political mess of our time.
So I've got to draw a line there. John Grimes, at the start of his speech, said that he represents big business, the big corporates, the big billion-dollar companies that are building renewables, that are investing in renewables.
Smart Energy Council represents the multi-billion-dollar firms that invest in the transition.
A lot of that is Chinese. The companies are Chinese, the products are Chinese. The people who work in those companies are Chinese. John Grimes is not Chinese, not externally, but he seems to be very fond of how they do business. This appears to me to be a perfect example of one side complaining about the other side doing something when in fact they're doing it themselves. So there's no doubt that there's big Chinese money in, or big business money in, the renewables lobby. It's a huge industry, and this is the end game for renewables globally is the churn. They like 10-year life cycle on batteries. They like 7-year life cycle on electric vehicles. They like a 15-year, 20-year life cycle on wind and solar. maybe a bit longer on industrial stuff, this is where the money is, the churn. And this is why I find people like John Grimes so completely unbelievable and inauthentic. If somebody was up there giving a speech to the Press Club of Australia saying, bloody, bloody, blah, we are here, we're big business, we are big coal, big gas, we want a heap of money and a heap of subsidies from the taxpayers, and we're going to build this stuff everywhere, and it's just going to be great, and most of the money is going to go back to a foreign company, you know, they'd be outraged. And this is exactly right. But no one seems to be outraged about this whole process. But Grimes boasts about his access and his influence on Australian government policy.
Smart Energy Council was central in informing the future Made in Australia policy and much more. And I want to take the opportunity to give a big shout out to Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen, a highly effective minister. He makes up his own mind, but arguably the most effective minister in cabinet for his portfolio.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. I thank the honourable member for her question and her interest in the Hydrogen Head Start program, which is vital to Australia's future as a renewable energy powerhouse, which this government fundamentally believes in. And we also know that our green hydrogen future is fundamental to that clean energy future as a powerhouse. And I'm happy to confirm for the honourable member that the funding under the Hydrogen Head Start program is limited to hydrogen generated by renewable energy, green hydrogen.
Oh dear, it wouldn't be the Baseload podcast without an appearance from Minister Chris Bowen. And that was him 2 years ago in Question Time, spruiking the, I don't know what you call it, the benefits maybe, I don't know, of hydrogen. After that segment, he went on to say how pleased the hydrogen lobby was at his intervention in the extra funding. Yeah, who would have thought? I'm skipping forwards a bit now in the John Grimes speech to the questions. Question time at the end. And there wasn't too much going on there. There was a little bit. There was a question from a Sky News guy about should the Smart Energy Council be still registered as a charity considering its political lobbying? Grimes fielded that question pretty well. I guess he's prepared for that. But this other one caught me by surprise. See what you make of this question from the host of the Press Club, an ABC journalist.
Do we need greater veto and override powers by governments to do away with objections from landholders?
Geez, you can imagine the head of the renewable energy lobby slavering over a policy like that. But didn't I just read something out just like that, which was introduced into the New South Wales Legislative Council recently, a bill which gave the minister sweeping powers to approve and authorise and make companies comply? I don't know. Maybe it's all going to go that way. Let's quickly see what John Grimes thinks about it all.
What's happening in rural and regional Australia is that social licence is being weaponised to stop the transition. We have companies in New South Wales where they receive objections for their project to proceed. Now, in New South Wales, if you get 50 objections, it automatically triggers a review process, right? It slows the whole thing down. Well, recently we had a company and they received 51 objections. Three of them were from locals. The rest were from people who could put their name to an objection, right? You get the same 47 people every time, right? Just a piece of cake.
People in glass houses should not throw stones. The renewable energy lobby should realise that people are going to use their own tactics against them. And what do you know? They're good tactics. They work.
We also know that the coalition is telling us a lie when they say that Australians don't back the transition in our regions. Polling consistently shows 16-17% of Australians are against the transition. And Greg, some of them have valid concerns, right, that we should absolutely take seriously.
You can smell the condescension. 16% of people have concerns. They're the ones who have to host the transmission lines or live next to a wind farm. Good grief. The arrogance of this lot, Grimes in particular, is quite astounding.
They really did stop trying to sell the project to us, and they basically just told us it's a state significant project. We have a license to do this from the very top, and we're here, and we are charging ahead in the face of overwhelming community opposition.
I would say to any investor that's got planning approval or is looking to get planning approval in Victoria for projects, please keep coming. You should be confident that you will be able to connect up and be able to sell your electricity.
But to realise our renewable energy potential, we need urgent reform. If we do not, Australia risks becoming the Kodak economy of the future. A really big deal one day and gone the next, all because it refused to change. We need to speed up the rollout on our grid, to smash the connection delays, to fix outdated planning and environmental laws. Energy market rules built for a fossil fuel past.
Certainly a degree of moral superiority that is thrown around. It's claimed, obviously, to be environmental and they're trying to save the world. And we were even asked if we want to keep the lights on, so which is really a condescending thing to ask a group of people. But it really was... It's quite a disgusting display of arrogance and entitlement that we saw last week at our town meeting.
Smart Energy Council represents the multi-billion dollar firms that invest in the transition.
Robert Bryce, welcome to the Baseload Podcast.
I'm happy to be with you, Ben. Thanks.
Yeah, and obviously off camera, back down in the lobby of the motel where we're at, thanks to Scott and the team at the Institute of Public Affairs for bringing you to Australia. And I hope you've been treated well. How's it going so far?
Oh, look, I love Australia. This is my wife, Lauren, is with me. This is our third trip, and fantastic. I love Aussies. The food's great. You know, an amazing country.
Excellent. And We had lunch earlier, and you mentioned some bird watching, a bit of a passion of yours, a hobby. Is there any other bucket list items apart from catching a, you know, I mentioned bin chickens, but...
Well, in Australia in general, I'd love to go back to the Great Barrier Reef. I haven't been there. I also want to go back to the outback. I want to see Ayers Rock, but not going to have time for that this week because IPA is keeping me busy, but... Look, I'm just thrilled to be here, and went birding in Port Douglas when I was here before. It was 9 years ago, Lauren.
That's an awesome spot.
And fantastic. We had just a lovely day. We saw the Papuan frogmouth, which is a really unusual bird. I remember.
Is that a type of owl?
It looks kind of like an owl, but okay. Papuan frogmouth. So I don't know what we've got a guide in Melbourne when we go on Saturday. So I'm sure it's all going to be new to me. So it's all exciting.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Now, I always do this to foreign guests that land here in Australia. We have a thing called fish and chip shops, and you would call, I don't know what you call them over in America. God knows. But what I like to do is suggest that if you do get time, go and find someone local who you're hanging out with in your travels and ask him to take you to a local fish and chip shop.
Oh, yeah.
And ask for a burger with the lot. And then just see what happens. Because you might get some interesting things on your burger depending on where you are. And it's always an interesting mission. Beetroot, eggs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't know. I'm not about the beets. This is one thing where I just completely, you Aussies have lost your minds. Beets on burgers? Oh, forget it. It's terrible.
Oh, yeah. At least we don't have beetroot on pizza yet, so we'll see what happens. Now, that's onto the real thing. So I've got a little bit of a thing here that I've wrote up. So
sure.
Basically, I was an avid listener of the Power Hungry podcast.
Yeah.
From around 2018, I think I started on my journey, my awakening to become informed about the energy system and renewables. Even though I work in the energy sector, I hadn't paid any attention to the political or the external stuff that's going on, right? So I was very much in my little bubble. Hopefully now I've broken out a bit. Now, your podcast was somewhat formative for me, your guests, and I just wanted to rattle off some names.
Sure.
Chris Wright.
Sure.
Obviously US, now the US Energy Secretary. Doomberg.
Sure.
Meredith Angwin, Schellenberger.
The world's famous the most famous green chicken on the planet.
Unreal, yeah. And the team there have a great take on things. You know, they cut right to it, and they're really good. Emmett Penny, Richard Lindzen, Grace Stanky, politicians, influencers, businessmen, scientists, Judith Curry, Chris Kiefer, Roger Pielke Jr., Mark Nelson, Simon Michaud, Alex Epstein, even our friend Stephen Wilson, and surprisingly, Tony Abbott, which is interesting. I saw him pop up. Now, you've also testified at Congress and written books. And obviously, there's a lot of people in your career. But I also recall a tense chat with a climate scientist. I don't know if you remember his name. I can't recall his name, but he was not impressed with your. He was actually more offended by your objectivity when you were sort of talking about, well, you know, there's other priorities, right? Maybe the climate is not the we can't have the impact that you think we're going to have. And he did like to argue with you, and it was really interesting. I'd love to find it again. But in
was that Bill McKibben or
yes,
was it?
That's yeah. him, Bill McKibben. Yeah, he was not impressed.
He was insufferable.
Yeah, he was a little bit difficult. So I quite enjoyed that because I listened to podcasts on the bus to and from work.
Sure.
So in my I'm getting to my question. So it's a long build up, but in your time having these discussions with all these people, has the Overton window opened at all? Are more people listening, or at least receptive to an objective discussion that challenges the green narrative?
I do think things have shifted, and I think a lot has changed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We're seeing more, I like to use this phrase energy realism, but I think it's also another good way I think of it is energy sobriety, right? We have to be very sober. For instance, I'm very pro-nuclear, but I'm also very sober about the challenge in expanding nuclear in the United States. And you know this here in Australia as well. It's one of the reasons why I'm really, truly baffled by Australia. You have more uranium resource than any other country in the world, and you won't build any reactors. But
we find it tough to explain as well, don't worry.
Yeah, but we can come back to that. But I do think that a number of things have happened, not just the Russia-Ukraine war, but also a realization and a generational shift, particularly when it comes to nuclear energy, where you have people like Emmett Penny, like Mark Nelson, Grace Stanky, coming to the into the public square saying, look, we have to have nuclear. And many of them are coming at it from the climate angle, which is fine. I could come at it from the climate angle or simply energy security or energy diversity. But that has shifted. And I think that has not just been in the U.S. It's been all over the world, particularly in Western Europe. And that's partly because net gas prices in Europe are much higher than they are in the U.S. So the Overton window has shifted, and dramatically so, I think.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear you say that, because sometimes here in Australia we struggle a little bit, but I think it's also important to take a step back and realize that the conversation is starting to shift, and there is maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel. I don't know. One of your often repeated phrases is the iron law of electricity.
Yeah.
And I think that firmly puts energy security at the top of the list when it comes to like priorities. Trump and his appointments, like Chris Wright, seem to get that.
Yeah.
What about the rest of the world? Do they get your iron law of electricity yet?
Well, I think they do. Briefly, what is the iron law of electricity? It's that people will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. That electricity is so important to modern life that people will steal it. They will produce it themselves. They will pay high prices. They will, you know, they will beg, borrow, or steal to get electricity because it is that important. And just to credit where credit's due, I borrowed this idea of the iron law from my friend Roger Pilkey Jr., who coined the iron law of climate, and which says, when forced to choose between action on climate change and economic growth, policymakers will choose economic growth every time. So the iron law of electricity is kind of an offshoot of that, saying, look, this is realism. This is realism when it comes to power, that people understand, people always everywhere understand the criticality of electricity to their lives. And so they don't, you know, climate change, yeah, they may have some interest in it, but it takes a distant backseat to making sure they can have the fridge run or the air conditioner run or you name it, or their cell phone, of course.
Yeah, of course. And not to mention travel and food and, you know, medicine and plastics and all the things needed to run a modern society. Right?
Of course. And that's the key part of it, that we've become, let me just back up for just a second. You know, we forget about how short the age of electricity is in all of human existence.
Yes.
It's just only in the last, my grandmother grew up she was born in a house that was built over a cave house in Billings, Oklahoma. She was born in a house without electricity. This is not ancient history. Yeah. My friend Chris Cawthon, his father, Ron Cawthon, grew up in Veneta, Oklahoma. He remembers the day in 1947 when his farm was connected to the grid.
Yes.
This is within living memory. And so we forget about how recent this incredibly important this life-changing, this epic-changing form of energy is in our lives, and we take it for granted. But we take it for granted at our extreme peril.
Taking it for granted, yeah, it's so dangerous. And you're right, I have a similar story. My mum, she grew up where the stove, they would get coal delivered.
Yeah.
And they'd have to keep the stove running.
Sure.
Through winter, through summer, whatever, and the kitchen is always a hot place, whatever. So, and they grew up with electricity, and they remember the electricity coming on as well. And then there's a whole telecommunications revolution as well, which wouldn't exist without the electricity to underpin it, all that fun stuff.
And that's remarkable in itself that, you know, I think you're maybe a little younger than I am, but this is just your mother's age. I'm talking about my grandmother, right? Yes. You know, my mother grew up in the age of electricity. She was born in 1925, yep. Right? So, but this isn't ancient history. And I think that now why I was so happy to be invited by the IPA to come back to Australia is what I see here is this this kind of blithe ignorance and among policymakers that, oh, we can just do all these things with the electric grid and everything's going to be fine. No, goddamn, no. You can't just, you know, make these massive changes to the supply without affecting the integrity of the system. And the system itself is very fragile. And you have to make sure that you, and we see that with the blackouts in Spain. What happened? It was a fragile system. They thought, oh, we can just amp up the renewable, the amount of wind and solar. Well, look what happened. Now, they don't want to admit that this over-reliance on alt energy was the problem, but it clearly was one of the, if not the key factors in the collapse of the grid.
It has to be. And you talk about the iron law of electricity coming from the iron law of climate, which is that policymakers should eventually prioritize economics over the climate.
Yeah.
Let's just hope we get somewhere there in Australia, because we're going the opposite way at the moment in Australia. Our productivity is down, our electricity costs are up, energy costs are up, and we seem determined to shoot ourselves in the foot. Now,
but if I can just add one quick thing, Ben, and that is look at Germany, the iron law of electricity in Germany. What are they doing? They're ramping up their coal plants. Right. So now Germany
instead of their nuclear plants.
And they may well bring their nuclear plants back online. There is a real possibility that will happen. And now we've had this change in government there with Merz coming in and so on. But the iron law of electricity is playing out in Germany, which is going to waste $1 trillion. I mean, absolutely idiotic. $1 trillion on the energy Wende. It's one of the biggest miscalculations of any modern country in the last 20 years.
Drastic consequences
for the deindustrialization of Germany, the reduction in their auto sector, et cetera. But the iron law of electricity is playing out there. Right. Oh, well, you're not going to run out of electricity. No, we're going to burn lignite. Lignite, Ben. Lignite, which is the most carbon-intensive form of power generation known to man.
But they will do it because they have to. And here in Australia, and you've mentioned earlier that Australia is in this incredibly fortunate position with the natural resources we have, the space to actually mine them and dig them up. And that's generally, I guess, where we came to the phrase called the lucky country maybe a few decades ago. Not so lucky now. Robert, you're clear on the benefits of nuclear power.
Yeah.
Is it correct to say you're less confident of the industry's ability to deliver on maybe even on just some of the obvious Trump promises, doubling, tripling, whatever he wants to do?
Well, I've been saying the same thing about, I'm a simple man, Ben. I mean, I have these, I've been saying the same thing for 15 years. Regardless of what you think about decarbonization, the best no regrets path for moving forward is natural gas to nuclear. We can decarbonize. These are super abundant resources, reliable technologies that are well-developed, widespread availability. But that makes particular sense for Australia. But just broadly about the nuclear power comeback and nuclear energy resurgence, and there is one underway. It's happening in the U.S. It's happening slower than I would like, and it's going to be constrained because I think of government support issues. But look, you know, you mentioned Secretary Wright. He was in Poland a few weeks ago. They're going to build 3 AP1000s. Poland is. This is the Westinghouse design. And why? Because Poland wants to reduce its reliance on coal. They're not going to rely on Russian gas. The Poles have a long history with Russians, and all of it's bad, right? So they're going to use American technology and build nuclear there for a lot of reasons. One is energy security. Second is they want to diversify away from coal. But I think third, that they understand that they need to have their own resource, their own availability of their own reactors, and they can't rely on any other country. And they're close to the Americans, so they're going to use American technology.
And this is an energy security argument that they're raising.
Absolutely.
They're happy to spend the money up front because they know that it will pay off when they don't have to use Russian gas or anything else they need.
Right. And the French are in the same situation. I think, you know, there was a time where Macron was saying, oh, we're going to turn more to renewables. Mm. And then we had the invasion of Ukraine. And suddenly the French are saying, oh, no, we're a nuclear company.
Now they're stable, reliable, secure electricity is in high demand throughout Europe. Right. Right? They're
And what's interesting about France, in my view, is that you look at them and they're, you know, this is a country that has deployed more nuclear quicker than any other country in history. They built 3 gigawatts a year for about 20 years.
Yeah.
But they all built the same, and this is the key challenge, they built the same design. They had one reactor design that was from designed by Framatome, and then they just started, I say stamping them out. It's more than just stamping them out. But they just replicated that same design over and over and over
again. That makes so much sense from a supply chain and logistics point of view.
And so then they built 50 or 60 reactors, something like that. So if we're going to have a nuclear comeback, we're going to have to do something like the French in that we're going to have to narrow down the number of reactors or the types of reactors. That is, we're going to have to settle on a chemistry.
Yep.
Is it going to be light water? Is it going to be molten salt? Is it going to be, it's not going to be thorium, but, you know, is it going to be light gas cooled? Is it going to be molten salt? You know, that's going to have to be narrowed as well as the size of the reactors. It would be the wrong pathway to say, oh, we're just going to do 20 different designs. No,
yes.
It's too complicated.
I agree. Yeah. So I think, yeah, Secretary Wright seems to have the right idea.
Yeah.
You can say that. Good appointment in your opinion?
Fantastic.
Yep. Yeah.
There are a lot of things that Donald Trump has done where I think, I don't want to
talk too much. He can be a bit loose sometimes. Yeah, agree.
I think he's just, you know, he's about to say kind of a lunatic. I think he is a lunatic. But there's some of the things he's done on the energy front that I think I applaud him wholeheartedly.
Because he understands
the fundamental importance of it. Now, some of these other things where he's one day on tariffs, it's this, one day on that. Oh, let's send in the Marines to Los Angeles. It's like, you know, it's just erratic and unreliable and just, you know, I mean, just completely nonsensical.
Yep. But Chris Wright's a good one.
But Chris Wright understands this, and he and Secretary Burgum,
he's the Secretary for the Interior.
Yeah, the Secretary of Interior. They understand that energy is fundamental, and this is something that Trump really gets, and he's full force behind it. I'm losing
full bottle, maybe.
Yeah, there we go. Here. Full bottle, is that an Australianism? Okay, yeah, full bottle behind the nuclear push, and he issued those executive orders a few days ago, which is the most important endorsement of nuclear power by an American president since Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech in 1953.
You mentioned the we don't want to diversify nuclear technology. You want to sort of go down a path and get really good at that path, and that sorts out a lot of things. Does that mean there's that's a good opportunity for or good reason for government intervention in that space to actually narrow the guardrails a bit on those choices?
Well, I'd modify what you said there, Ben, just a little bit. It's not government intervention. It has to be full square government backing. You know, this is the issue with nuclear power that makes it makes it more challenging. I won't say problematic. Why are the Chinese building so many reactors? It's because the government controls industry. Why has Rosatom been so successful at deploying? Because Rosatom is owned by the Russian government.
Canada as well.
Canada, the CANDU reactor is, it's a Canadian design. Ontario Power Generation is partly owned by the Ontario government, or is it the Ontario Pension Fund? But anyway, there's a very strong government hand in Ontario in the nuclear sector. And so that's one of the reasons why the Ontario Power Generation said we're going to double the size of the Bruce Power Station. So this is, you know, nuclear. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear, whether, you know, in my view is if you're anti-nuclear and anti-carbon dioxide, you're pro-blackout. Well, I'm anti-blackout. Believe me, I was blacked out in Texas.
Me too.
Yeah, in Winter Storm Uri. But the challenge with nuclear is that it needs long-term, and that means decadal support from government. and it's going to be in the regulatory aspect. It's going to end capital, fuel management. All of these things have to come together. And so I'm hopeful that the U.S. and the Trump administration is going to be, give a big boost to nuclear, but we also have to be very clear about what those challenges are. And here in Australia, you just got to get off the damn dime. I mean, you just have to get going. And, you know, and the anti-nuclear crowd here, give them credit. They've been very effective. But, you know, I also think they've been effective and destructive.
Yeah, well, I would pigeonhole the Australian anti-nuclear crowd as the pro-renewables lobby. But we'll talk about that in a second.
Sure.
I don't want to spend too much time on Trump and bits and pieces, but my final question in this sort of this section we're talking about is, what's your thoughts on Trump's effect on global energy policies, on net zero, all of the above? Can Trump and maybe his legacy, like if the Republicans and the Trump style stays in for longer, is that a force for good around the world, do you think?
That's interesting. Let me put it back to you this way, Ben. There's some interesting timing with Trump's election, right? And the U.S. election was November 5th, I think. The German coalition government collapsed 2 days later. Now, I'm not saying this is the Trump effect. What was interesting that the coalition collapsed at the same time Germany was hit by the Dunkelflaute, right? The wind stopped blowing. And you know, a couple of days there, they had to ramp up every coal station, every gas-powered station to make sure the lights stayed on. So there are some things that have happened since Trump's election that have reverberated. Now, some of them, I think, you had your opposition leader here was Peter Dutton, right?
Yep, and
not only did the liberals, your conservatives, lose, but Dutton lost his seat.
Yeah, and they somewhat blamed the Trump effect for that. Yeah.
And in Canada, Pierre Poilievre,
he
lost his seat as well. So there's a downside to this Trumpism, right? And a serious
one. Yep.
But I also think it's not just Trump, right? You know, this sobriety, energy realism has been building for a while. And it's partly the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
It's partly a reaction just to the reality of what's going on, right? People see it and they don't like it. They think, hang on, this is dangerous. And it comes back to security and cost.
And cost, especially. Now, so there have been, you know, a lot of counter indicators. But I do, you know, going back, we talked about it earlier, I think there has been a shift in the kind of the public's understanding, the public's acceptance of nuclear, the public's weariness of climate catastrophism. I think that that's very real. And also, and I was talking with Mia Schlick from the IPA earlier, and some of the survey work they've done, an opinion analysis. You know, very few people, very few average Australians, very few average Americans are willing to pay anything extra for climate protection.
That's an important point.
And this is in public opinion surveys that have been validated many times. So there is I think political leaders, it's convenient to say, yes, renewables, and it's very popular, politically popular. They always poll very well. But when it comes down to brass tacks, when it gets down to the reality of who's going to pay, well, the individual consumers saying, well, I don't want to pay extra. I like that idea, but I don't want to pay more for it.
Well, I can certainly only vouch for myself in that area, and I definitely don't want to pay extra.
Yeah.
I'm a beneficiary of subsidies for rooftop solar myself.
Right.
I don't have any.
And what is that subsidy? How much?
Oh, right. So it works in a couple of ways. So you get a credit up front on 15 years of production from your solar panels.
A credit, and that goes to defray your power bill?
No, that goes to defray the installation cost of the equipment.
Oh, okay. So the credit then is the government pays the installer.
Correct. The installer gets a contract from you, the owner, that says, yes, I want to install this and I agree to pay some money. They take that to the government at some point, cash it in for some credits, whatever the kilowatt size is, and they get money based on that.
I see. Okay, right.
So that's an upfront subsidy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the second part of what I call the three tiers of benefit is a feed-in tariff.
Yeah.
So depending on the which decade you got signed up to, I was signed up in the last decade, you can get up to 50 cents a kilowatt hour. Yeah. $500 a megawatt hour, even when the market's zero, right?
Good for you.
Yeah. I'm mad if you don't, but I must say that all those are disappearing now. A lot of this feed-in tariffs, which I think will eventually go negative. They're going to start fining people, right?
Yeah.
But they're down about 3 cents a kilowatt hour in most places in Australia. And then the third effect is that, of course, you don't pay the increasing electricity bills because you've got the subsidized solar reducing your consumption. So the whole thing is, it's a wealth transfer that's well recognized. So that's happened. Now,
I have solar on the roof of my house in Austin as well. And we have 8.5 kilowatts of solar. And why did I do it? Well, look, I'm opposed to all subsidies unless I'm getting them, Ben. All right.
The best subsidy of all.
I hate subsidies of all kinds. But if you're going to give me a subsidy, well, bring it on.
Yep.
But I got the same thing. I got three different subsidies. I paid $7,700 off of my federal income tax bill. Not a deduction, an actual credit off what the amount that I owed Uncle Sam. The city of Austin paid a third of the installation costs, and I'm still getting this net energy metering, a feed-in tariff, as you call it. I forgot what the number. It was $120 a megawatt hour, and the wholesale price of electricity in Texas is $30 a megawatt hour. So, you know, three different big old fat subsidies. Well, bring it on. Yeah. But it is fundamentally unfair, and it's a class issue. And so the... maybe the cashed up Bogans.
Bogans is the right word. Bogan, right? Rednecks and
the cashed up Bogans might have rooftop solar, but the working class Bogans, people who don't, or renters,
they're not, single parents, pensioners,
yep. Or they live in rental housing. They can't afford to have this installed.
They just do without the benefits of a modern society.
So it's a wealth transfer. And I'm talking about that tonight here in my presentation in Brisbane, but Ashley Brown at Harvard a few years ago called it, this is Robin Hood in reverse.
It is, yeah.
This is the poor subsidizing the rich.
And we're about to go into the next phase of this, which is obviously that now there's EV tax breaks for people who can afford to opt into that saving.
Sure.
As well as the battery subsidy, where they're up to around about 30% of a 10 kilowatt hour system you'll get from the government, which is from people who aren't paying for batteries. They're just going to pay more. It's incredible.
They're in all of this... You know, you didn't ask me this question, Ben, but I, you know, as you noted,
I'm
a recovering podcaster. I like doing the Power Hungry podcast, but I was just working too much and I just had to make something, something had to go away. And so that was it. What motivates me and what I do, and I'm incredibly lucky to do what I do. I travel around the world. I give speeches. I write but I care about working class people. My dad grew up, worked his way through school in Oklahoma, and he really had an appreciation for working class folks, and he passed that on to me. So who do I care about? I care about the people whose names are on their shirts. I care about the people who turn wrenches, who pour the coffee, who fix things, grow things, build things. I love those people. And here in Australia, they're just getting screwed. They're just getting screwed by these elite notions around energy and power that we can just tinker at the margins and we can do it all with weather-dependent generation and, climate change. It's a delusion. Mm-hmm. And that's the message that I've thought about, in these presentations that IPA's asked me to give, and I'm happy to do it. It's just my message to Australians, you got to sober up here. What are you doing? I mean, truly, what are you doing? You're screwing yourselves. You have all these incredible resources. You're an energy superpower, just running yourself into the ditch. And there are plenty of reasons for you to understand why you shouldn't be doing it. But to me, my message is very simple. You got to sober up and look at the way the world is instead of this kind of fanciful kind of idea about, we love wind and solar. Well, give yourself a party, but you're screwing the poor and the middle class.
I wish our audio only listeners could see the expression on Robert's face as he's laying down the truth there. This leads me exactly into my next question, which is... I spoke to Doomberg on this podcast. I was really fortunate to talk to those guys at the end of 2024. They'd just written an article which basically told Australia to grow up and take a good hard look at ourselves, kind of like what you just said then. So focusing on energy security and affordability. Doomberg pointed out that when plotted on the same chart with China, Australia's emissions are indistinguishable from the x-axis.
Yeah.
What's your advice for Australia in those terms, if anybody's listening out there?
Well, sure. And I have a chart that I'm presenting and I'm going to publish on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. Doomberg, of course, is on Substack as well. But yeah, since 2000, Australia's percentage of global CO2 emissions has gone from 1.5% to 1.1%. So yes, you've reduced your emissions somewhat. And meanwhile, over that same time period, if memory serves, and I think I know this pretty well, China plus India, their emissions have gone from 18% to over 40%.
And Robert, if I can interject there, I would say that, and I haven't looked at the numbers myself, but there's a good chance that our, even if we maintain the same tons of emissions, our percentage would still drop because the rest of the world is growing.
Correct. And so this is the challenge. You know, look, I love Australians. They're so friendly and, you know, they're jovial and they'd like to, you know, have a laugh and a pint, I think. But there, you have to be realistic about your standing in the world and what you're doing. And this is the same situation with Germany or any of these other countries that have declared net zero. Australia is one of 32 countries, as well as the EU, who have legal binding mandates for net zero. And yours is by 2050. But it doesn't, I hate to tell you this, you Australians just don't matter anymore when it comes to this issue. Right, you're gonna rock the world in rugby and footy and all these other things and swimming and all the things you're good at, right? But when it comes to CO2 emissions, the story is China and India. It's not Australia. The story is China and India. And unless or until those 2.8 billion people decide we want to burn less coal, then the CO2 emissions globally are going to continue rising. That's
and the stupidity is that we consider ourselves. In the green narrative, that is, I'm sort of speaking, looking in from outside. The Australian story is, we're doing so well with renewables.
Yeah.
But all we're doing is putting those emissions over in China.
Right.
Which means that their emissions go up regardless. And the whole thing doesn't make any sense. So.
Well, and I'll just add one quick thing, and that is that in all of this discussion around climate and all of these issues around energy and power, there's a whole clack, a whole group of people who's only, it's renewables are the goal. It's like, you know, as my friend Steve Brick, you know, he kind of jokes about it. He says, so what's the question? Doesn't matter the question. The answer is renewables, right? Right. You know, what's the solution? Batteries. What's the answer? What's the question? Oh, it doesn't matter. What's the solution? Batteries, you know. So there's this fixation, a romanticization of wind and solar as because they are renewable. But as my friend Jesse Ossibel has said memorably, they may be renewable, but they are not green. And that make one other quick point. One of the things the IPA is rolling out is this renewable rejection database documenting the backlash across rural Australia against high voltage transmission, wind, solar, batteries. And I'm thrilled that they're doing it because I've done the same thing globally and in the US. It's not just a 2 or 3 or 4. No, it's hundreds of cases. Hundreds of cases. And in the global rejection database, which I maintain, I've counted 27 rejections or restrictions of wind or solar just since January 1st in Scotland, Ireland, and the UK alone.
Yep. And these are big projects that are getting knocked back because of community objections.
Yeah.
And that probably doesn't even count the ones where the investors say, nah, sorry, it doesn't add up because the subsidies have been pulled or something like that.
Or they pull it because they see the local opposition is so stout. But you had one just in the last couple of weeks. It was a 450 megawatt project in Queensland near Rockhampton that was rejected by the provincial government. Because, you know, these politicians, what do they want? They want to stay in power.
They want to be reelected.
They want to be reelected.
They need the people's agreement to stay in their jobs.
The social license for these, in many cases, just flat idiotic wind and solar projects. The social license is wearing thin.
Does that ring very true? And I guess from your perspective, from the multiple countries, there's a pattern there. I did a really cheeky. When I say cheeky, I mean really cheap and nasty graphic, which was I used Microsoft PowerPoint. I took a graphic of an Australian map, which was coloured based on the election outcome.
Yeah.
And then I overlaid with a bit of transparency where all the renewable energy zones are planned to go.
Yeah.
And what do you know? They're all going in the places that don't vote for them.
Yeah.
Incredible as that may sound. So at some point,
well, this is the exact same thing in the US, right? Where did, you know, the US, we have 3,600 counties, something like that. Trump won 3,100 roughly of them, right? And Kamala Harris won about 500, but they're all urban counties, right? So That's the same.
What about Austin?
It's the same political dynamic. Well, Austin is anomalous in Texas. It's a Democratic. It's a blue region in Texas, right?
An island,
or as a current mayor in Austin said, he calls it the blueberry and the tomato soup bowl.
I can visualize that. That's good.
But yeah, I mean, the rural areas are overwhelmingly the ones that are being forced in some cases to take these big alt energy projects. And it's the Democrats in the cities who want them.
But the people in the regions, and I said this the other day on X, they're asked to produce the food and the fiber.
Yeah.
They're asked to herd the cattle. They're asked to provide the natural resources with the mines.
Yeah.
And now they've been asked to host the wind farms and solar farms and the transmission lines to make electricity cost more and be less reliable.
Yeah.
There's a certain element of clownish, cartoonish element to that, which bothers me a little bit.
But it's also the class issue applies here as well, right? Because urban voters tend to be more wealthy. But I think, just one quick point, and we mentioned it earlier, but when we weren't on the air, but the AMO report that just came out recently about high voltage transmission and the inflation blowouts, I mean, it's just incredible. Credit to Joe Nova, who has done great work. I met her in Perth, was it two nights ago? Impressive woman and very incredible work ethic.
Yeah, Joanne's great. Yeah.
Yeah. But she looked at this and that made me go to the report itself and look at it again. And 55% inflation in some of these projects in one year. I mean, that's just it's just incredible. And you add in the fact that all across rural Australia, the graziers, as you call them, we call them ranchers, and the farmers are saying, hell no. And there's that one great picture that was Joe Nova published, Piss Off Austnet, right? Where some farmer had carved it into his wheat field or whatever.
Austnet's transmission company.
Yeah, Piss Off Austnet, right? Yeah. But it's all about land use. Mm. Energy policy and land use are two sides of the same coin. And it's one of the other reasons why I'm so pro-nuclear.
Small footprint.
Yeah,
it's incredible. How long can the green narrative hang on? Is there a tipping point? I've talked about more pain needed. You've got the iron law of electricity, more pain needed. And there's the other one, which is Breitbart's famous saying, politics downstream of culture, which they're all sort of dancing around the same tune, is that at some point enough people will say no and reject it. Can you see that happening in parts of the world better than others? I mean, we've had Trump 2016, we got Brexit, we've got Trump again. Not that it's all energy related, but there is a certain authoritarian UN influence which people are sort of starting to reject a little bit.
I think it's rejecting a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that you've seen, now, are we at a tipping point? Are things fundamentally shifting?
I don't think we are yet, but
I think in some aspects we are, for instance, on the wind side. You look at the deployments of wind energy globally. In fact, some of the latest IEA numbers, those numbers are falling and falling dramatically, right? Because wind energy, and I'm a longtime critic of the wind business, I hate those people. I've seen how they act in rural America, and I think they act despicably. I mean, I've seen it over and over and over again. And part of my intense dislike, I said hate. I reserve hatred for lima beans and cauliflower, but okay, so my intense dislike.
Some people, it's coriander.
My intense dislike for the wind business is in years of observing how they act. And I mentioned I'm from Oklahoma. My mother grew up in Enid, a small wheat farming town. NextEra Energy, the largest alt energy company in the world, sued the town of Hinton, Oklahoma, a little bitty farming town in western Oklahoma, in state and federal court to try to force the town to take a wind project they didn't want. I mean, who does this?
And who's sticking up for those towns?
And who's sticking up for this little town? Being beat on by this corporate behemoth. Mm. I mean, if the oil and gas industry had done that, it would be front page news in the New York Times. But this kind of behavior has become commonplace. Invenergy, a Canadian-controlled company based in Chicago, the same kind of bare-knuckle kind of tactics. So it just infuriates me to see how this green patina, right, this clean energy push, this clean energy narrative, is in fact just a money grab and a land grab by very powerful corporate interests to effectively run over rural residents in the United States and here in Australia as well. A lot of foreign companies are the ones that are behind these big alt energy projects here in Australia as well.
Well, they've got the full backing of most of the local councils. The three layers of government in Australia are local councils, like Brisbane City Council. We're in Brisbane at the moment. Then you've got the states, Queensland, New South Wales, etc. And then you've got the feds.
Right.
And at some level, all of those three organisations or governments are backing the net zero and the green narrative, as well as the bureaucracies and all the people in the lobby groups. You mentioned the New York Times.
Right.
The media, I think, is firmly in the basket of there's some blame to be apportioned to the media for for not being impartial. I think they take sides, and it's so unfortunate. Is there a media transformation that's required? Is there some shame or something that has to switch on in the media and they go, actually, we'll make more sales by pushing back against renewables? Is that possible?
That's an interesting point. Let me just put that one other quick point. I thought it was interesting because I don't know why I hadn't thought of this before, but you just made it brings it to mind. So you mentioned here in Australia, so you have the three levels. You have the city, you have the, I'd say provincial, your state governments, and then the federal. Well, in the U.S., we have the city or the township or town level. Then we have the county.
Yep.
Then we have the state. And then we have the feds.
Okay.
Right? So one of the reasons why, and again, it just occurs to me as we're thinking about this, why I didn't think about it before, but why I've been able to document so many more rejections or restrictions of wind and solar in the U.S. is because we have that other county level of government that has been very active. And we have 3,600 counties in America, right? And 50 states, obviously, and one federal government. But that has been one other level by which citizens opposing these alt energy projects can voice their opinions and fend off these kinds of projects. Now, to your question about the media, the New York Times is hopeless. I mean, their coverage of alt energy and the rejections against wind and solar has been atrocious. I mean, absolutely atrocious. They're beyond hope. I quit my subscription to the New York Times. I'm a reporter. I've been subscribing for more than 40 years. I finally said, forget it. Piss off.
Did you write him a letter?
I didn't write him a letter, but I wrote about it and on my Substack and said, I'm quitting because they were demanding an 80% subscription price increase. I said, 80%?
Well, it's because less people are buying it, right?
20%, 30%, I might have considered, but 80, piss off, right? Mm. No way, no how, not going to happen. But I think that, and I've thought about this quite a lot because, Ben, I've been a reporter my whole career. I've never had a real job. I've been in journalism all my life. Things have changed, and it's one of the reasons why I'm on Substack, is that with Substack, I can write what I want, how I want, when I want, with the charts I want, and get it out there and right away. Now, do I have the reach of the New York Times? Of course I don't. But I also don't have to listen to some editor who's 32 years old and doesn't like what I prove this to me or whatever. I've been doing this twice as long as you. I know what I'm doing here. I'm good at what I do. So you see the success of someone like Doomberg or Barry Weiss or Michael Schellenberger or someone else who's used the Substack platform and others, some of the others, the Dispatch, other media outlets who have gone to the electronic model only, and they have succeeded. And I think that has been one of the factors that has undermined some of these traditional legacy media outlets, Washington Post, NPR, where you've seen their viewership, their readership plummet because they've discredited themselves. And so in many ways, that's unfortunate. But I also think it's a reflection of today's times in which people are looking for that trust in institutions has declined dramatically of all kinds, whether it's the Catholic Church or government or corporations or whatever. So people are looking for people who they trust, right? And people that they think are authentic and truthful, and that it's, I'm using this peer-to-peer kind of, idea instead of what used to be peer-to-business, right?
There's no Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, Walter Cronkite's,
people together.
Cronkite's dead,
yep.
Right? And he's not coming back to life. Right. But, a lot of these big TV outlets have discredited themselves or they, that explains the rise of podcasts. It explains in part the rise of Substack. But it, to me, as someone who's, I consider myself a reporter, right? Yep. I've made documentaries. I've written 6 books, but I'm a reporter. I think it's an honorable occupation. But as a reporter, having Substack, robertbryce.substack.com.
Indeed.
It's so good. As my friend Roger Pilkey, I was talking to him the other day, he said, it's almost too good to be true.
That's a really good story, actually. I like that. A little bit of independence, a little bit of freedom, less oversight, and maybe a bit more transparency and honesty, right?
And I have my own subscribers, and I owe them something. I owe them my best.
Yes.
And that's what I hope to offer. What is the characteristic, the thing that I want more than anything? It's authenticity.
Yes.
I want to make sure that I'm doing this authentically. Nobody's paying me. I don't, you know, I'm not on anybody's, you know, big oil or big gas or whoever. You know, I don't work for any of those cats.
Yep.
This is how I see it. I'm calling balls and strikes. This is what I do. And, you know, now that I'm on my dotage, I'm incredibly fortunate to do what I do.
More power to you, sir. What does the exit ramp look like for the net zero? We haven't talked much about net zero.
In Australia, you need a new government. You're going to have to get a new government in
but
place.
But even I would go as far as to say that the Conservative government we were may have elected still subscribe to net zero. And is net zero, for me, it's an impossibility. I think it's a fantasy, ridiculous thing. What's your thoughts?
Won't happen because it can't happen.
Can't happen, exactly right. So why?
It's physically impossible.
Indeed.
You can't
say that all the time.
Make it happen. It's impossible.
I'm not going to hug you, Robert. No, we're too old for those shenanigans,
right. No kissing either. But I've been in Australia since, I don't know, it's a week now. I haven't seen any electric cars. You know, if you're going to reach net zero.
You will.
All these petrol cars, we call them gasoline, you know, diesel cars, all of them are going to have to be replaced. And you're going to have to replace them all in 25 years. Come on. It's not going to happen. If gasoline didn't exist, if diesel fuel didn't exist, we'd have to invent them. They're miraculous substances. And so the entire notion, I need to look up the data on the oil consumption, but I would bet you, I'd put a $100 bill, in the US we call them Benjamins, I'd put a $100 bill on the table right near that says, over the past, you know, 20 years, Australia's oil consumption has might have ticked down just a little bit, but only a little, because this country runs on transportation runs on oil. Period. Everywhere, always, all the time.
And you've been pretty clear about the diesel engine.
It's a marvel.
Yeah, it is.
And so is the auto cycle engine. I mean, these are miraculous designs that companies like Toyota and Hyundai and Kia and I did see a BYD
and Caterpillar.
Yeah, but I did see a BYD, a Chinese EV, when I was in.
Oh, you'll see plenty here in Brisbane if you go out for a walk later on. You'll see lots of Teslas. A lot of them are subsidised to some extent, but like I don't care if people buy an electric vehicle. Go for it. Choose whatever mode of transport you like. I don't care if it's a battery scooter or whatever. But I would prefer not to have to contribute to it through my taxes.
Sure, of course not.
Indeed.
Selfish bastard.
What can I say? I'm in it for myself. Robert, this interview will air after your speaking tour.
Sure.
Where can people find your content? Are we talking YouTube? You've mentioned Substack. What about Twitter, LinkedIn? You've got books as well.
I'm easy to find, Ben. You know, Google. I'm on the Google, as they say. But yes, robertbryce.substack is where I'm publishing. Robertbryce.substack.com is where I'm publishing almost all my contents there. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on TikTok. Yeah, I'm on TikTok. You bet I'm on TikTok. Because China doesn't have quite enough power, so I want to make sure they keep in. But I'm very fortunate to do what I do. And so my daughter Mary helps me on some of my social media stuff. So I think it's important to make things available. And so I'm doing short videos and all those things. But I'm having a great time. You know, I'm just incredibly lucky to do what I do, and incredibly fortunate and happy to be back here in Australia, and really thankful to be talking with you.
Excellent. Well, you've been a great best guest, Robert. Thanks very much for coming on the Baseload Podcast.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Baseload Podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.